Hello and welcome to the January 20th edition of the SoxProspects.com podcast. My name is Chris Hatfield. You'll notice that I am not Mike Andrews. Mike won't be with us today, at least to start. We'll see if he is able to join us later on. Who knows? And with me today are our other two regulars, Chris Mellon. Hello, Chris.
How are you, Chris?
Good to talk to you again. And of course, joining us from Jersey, I believe, correct, is Ian Theodoritis. What's up, Ian?
Correct, Jersey. What's up, man?
How
it's good to be back, guys. We haven't talked in a while.
I know it's been a minute between the new year and between all kinds of other stuff, and admittedly, between my part of that being my not being where my reliable internet connection is so that we can record the podcast. So I'll take most of the blame on that.
It's tough lining up the schedules. I think that's our, our main obstacle.
It is, but
finding that common ground.
It's tough. We all have real lives too, so to speak. But we're here here to discuss some prospects in the sometimes a bit slow off season, but certainly plenty going on with the Red Sox between hiring of a new manager, the ever-elusive Theo Comp, which, sorry, we're not getting into that today because, frankly, it's a non-issue, at least in my opinion. Maybe at a later date we'll get into that.
Wait for the Rule 5 draft.
Well, hey, we'll mention the Rule 5 draft a little bit too, but a lot has happened, obviously, since our last podcast, which was back in November. So to start off, I think we're going to get into a little bit of that, a little bit of what's been going on in the meantime since we've talked. Two of the bigger prospect-related things involve prospects leaving the organization. Those, of course, were the trades of Jed Lowrie and Kyle Weiland for Mark Melancon from Arizona, and the trade of Josh Reddick, Miles Head, and Raul Alcantara for Andrew Bailey. Why did I almost call him Josh Bailey? I don't know why I almost call him Josh Bailey, but anyway.
Josh Bailey.
I don't know.
At
any rate. At any rate, I'm an idiot. This the between that and the, of course, hanging up on these guys when we went to record the podcast the first time. But at any rate, I just wanted to get you guys' thoughts on what the Red Sox got. Not necessarily, I mean, we know those are both big bullpen arms. The book is out on Melancon and Bailey. But as far as the trades themselves, what did you guys think on what the Sox gave up and in total how the Sox fared in those two deals? I guess we'll start with Ian.
I was surprisingly calm about the haul we gave up. Usually I'm very defensive about our prospects and very defensive about giving them up for well, it's usually with rentals midseason, but just relievers also in general. I'm a big Jed Lowrie fan, but I think we all kind of saw the writing on the wall at the end of the season. There just was not a place for him left in the organization. And Kyle Weiland, I guess he could end up being a Mark Melancon type, but you know, he's a kind of a future reliever one way or the other. And with the Bailey trade, again, I'm not even in love with Bailey. Like, I think there are real injury questions there, but I just kind of Reddick kind of falls in that same territory with me where Lowrie does. And Head, you know, is this kind of right-handed hitting short first baseman. Who knows with him? And Alcantara is just a live arm. I was surprised at how calm I was with the what we gave up.
I think I feel you on that. Mellon, what do you think? I know you've seen these guys at spring training, if not higher up on the ladder. What did you think of the haul that the Red Sox gave up for these two guys?
You know, I didn't think they gave up all that much in the grand scheme of things when you look at it. I think Houston, you know, in that deal, from their point of view, they got a lot because they got two guys, one in Lowrie, who they can pencil in as an everyday shortstop, or you know maybe third base type guy on that team, a last place team, and Weiland, I mean, they could just stick him in the rotation and have him eat up innings and get value in that way if they really wanted to. I think from their point of view, they got a good haul for him, and from the Red Sox point of view, they gave up some surplus and some guys who were kind of redundant. So I think the trade I think both teams kind of won that trade. If that makes sense, they both got what they wanted out of it. I was surprised that Oakland, you know, didn't kind of hold out for maybe a little bit more. You know, I thought maybe they could pry another player who might profile as more of a sure better or a little bit more projectable at the major league level, especially considering Miles Head, you know, the talk of moving him to third base was kind of perplexing when they announced that in their press conference. I don't know. I almost felt like, I know they scouted him, but I'm like, had they seen him play? Because he's rather bad body type, and he's just not a third baseman. So that was kind of intriguing to hear that from them. And then Alcantara, as Ian said, a live arm, but just so far away from the majors. And for me, a guy who kind of looks more, you know, like he's probably projects out as a reliever. But, you know, if everything goes right in the perfect scenario, a third starter type. You know, I know that when I was down in Instructs, some of the scouts down there were writing him up as a third slash fourth type starter, or maybe an eighth inning reliever, depending on, you know, how things go.
Yeah, to me, that the Bailey deal, it makes a little more sense if you see Head as a third baseman, because obviously the bat plays a lot better at third than it would at first base. But I, with you, I'm just, I mean, you know, we heard he made some strides in his defense as the season went on, but third base, I think that's
right. Yeah,
it's interesting.
Well, you know,
it's a great trade if you see Head as a shortstop, but he's not going to be either a shortstop or a third base. I mean,
right, right,
yeah. Because I mean, you, Chris, you saw him in spring training.
A little bit of him,
but I saw him during the season. John Mioli saw him during the season, and I even, you know, Evan Lepler, the Salem broadcaster, saw him during the season, and the three of us. You know, myself, Mioli, and Lepper all kind of responded to each when we were talking with each other that, well, that's kind of surprising. Like we had seen him, we know what he looks like. So it was kind of interesting that they thought that, and I just maybe think that's Oakland. Just, you know, they're a second division team, and they could throw him at third base and try it out, and it's really no consequences.
Obviously, a lot of that trade was laid down in the failed Rich Harden deal too. I mean, you wonder how much of that is Billy Bean and the Oakland front office maybe falling in love with a player. I mean, we know that Alcantara and Workman were the among those being offered as players to be named later in the Harden deal if that had gone through. So Alcantara is a guy they liked, you know, was had a guy that maybe they overthought, you know, a little bit too much and just wanting to get a deal done for Bailey. And then the other thing too is, I mean, how bad are the medicals on Bailey too? You know, if he's a guy that, you know, more or less isn't going to last a full season in any year of his career, then yeah, maybe that's a fair haul. But if he's a guy that can last for a full season, it looks a lot different. The thing with Weiland too, I mean, I for a team like Melanson was in Houston, right? Is Weiland a starter for a team like Houston? You know, kind of the way that maybe Masterson might not have gotten the opportunity to start had he stayed with the Sox, and he's turned out okay, at least as a starter. Maybe, I mean, does Weiland maybe stick at starter for a team like Houston? What do you guys think?
I mean,
you never know.
Go ahead, Chris. I was going to say, as a, you know, he was a back end of the rotation, second division team starter, so that lines up with Houston. But, you know, Weiland's stuff just doesn't look like it's going to, you know, be able to last for, you know, even maybe four innings at the major league level. And, you know, with Masterson has a much better fastball and has that dominant pitch. You know, that it's Masterson's fastball's plus for him. Whereas with Weiland, he doesn't really have a true plus pitch at his disposal. Maybe, you know, his fastball's probably plus, but it just seems like, yeah, he could be a starter by default. I don't know if you were going to agree with that, Ian.
I was going to basically echo what you said, which is you could start him and maybe in that division he'll get away with it. It's probably the worst or second to worst division in baseball right now. But why not try? I mean, his future one way or the other is in the bullpen. Why not see if you can get, like, a, you know, maybe a plus guy in the bullpen? That seems to be where you would better allocating your resources.
That sounds about right. And it's funny to me with looking at a guy like Alcantara. He seems like the type of guy that we always see in spring training. And not to jump back to the Bailey trade, but the other point I wanted to make on these guys is that he seems like the type of guy that never stays in the Sox organization for any length of time. You know, you look at the Roman Mendezes of the world and Alcantara Juan Rodriguez, right? Yeah. That was the other guy I was thinking of. I mean, I feel like Frank Montas is the next guy who's going to go that route. But
don't you dare say Frank Montas' name in that group.
In what sense?
I'm kidding. But I mean, I wonder if that's kind of a twofold issue, where there's also could that be an issue of development there, where Sox are not able to convert these raw arms into polished future starters?
And they know they can't, so they get rid of them.
I don't know, maybe.
Or maybe they just don't feel like they have the time. When I say not the time, but it's just that it takes so much time that
it's worth more to a team like Oakland or Houston to do that.
Because Ian makes a good point. I mean, they're all, you know, all the players that you, the names of the players you listen, they're all crude, real raw arms that have a lot of they have a lot of potential and raw talent, but they're all those guys are really crude pitching types where they don't really have much pulse, and you got to look, you're looking 5-6 years down the line, and maybe it's just the Red Sox feel like with those kind of assets they're just going to trade them off and get the most value they can now, and let someone else try to, you know, who has the time, develop them, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Sounds about right. Just a couple other quick things that have happened since the last podcast. We should probably hit on two. One is in the Rule 5 draft. The Red Sox picked up a couple of guys that to me looked like more or less minor league filler in Duarte and Olivares, a pitcher and a catcher. Who Olivares is a catcher from Tampa who has never played above short season ball, and I believe he's in his 20s at this point. And Duarte, I believe it's Marcos Duarte, correct?
Correct.
Probably an arm that'll start in Double A that will pitch out of the bullpen that, I don't know, we might get excited about when he has a hot streak of about a month, but he didn't strike me as anything super. But perhaps the bigger thing coming out of that day was the loss of Cesar Cabral again, which is probably the thing I should ask you guys about. Chris, you've seen Cabral plenty of times. No surprise he got picked again. Do you think there's any chance he sticks in New York?
Well, no surprise that he got picked. I think mm-hmm. teams are, you know, looking down the road with him, a lefty who can get his fastball up to 94 miles an hour, has a very good circle changeup and a curveball that if he can, you know, develop the repetition with it and get enough innings that he can, you know, throw the pitch and develop it. As with sticking with New York, I mean, it's a wild card situation. I think that, you know, maybe, but again, if you're looking at it and if you really valued him and wanted him to develop, why not, you know, maybe try to work out a trade to mm-hmm. with it for him rather than, you know, try to stash him and have him not pitching enough innings or not appearing in enough games in the minor leagues. Because with Cabral, I mean, you just want him throwing and you're kind of trying to see if he can feel that curveball out and then be a guy who could pitch, you know, 6th, 7th innings for you at the big league level.
If he doesn't stick, he becomes a free agent.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
So he's basically gone. Or he can opt to become a free agent, which means he'll
right.
become
he a free agent. You would imagine he would, right?
Yeah, there's no reason for him not to.
So he could get dropped by the Yankees and then sign right back with them? Is that how that would work?
He could sign with anybody.
I guess that theoretically, yeah, they could sign him, not put him on the 40-man. But yeah, I mean, he would probably go to he could probably get a major league deal somewhere. You would assume, right?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Like Kansas City or someone,
right?
Yeah, Pittsburgh or San Diego. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I remember someone projecting Kansas. Oh, Kansas City is actually the one that took him, weren't they?
They traded
him? They traded him to the Yankees, which I found interesting because it seems like I remember someone, I believe it might have been Jonathan Mayo, actually, before the Rule 5 draft had said that Kansas City was a spot where Cabral could wind up because they're the type of team that could use a lefty like that in the bullpen and could wait him out.
Right.
But, you know, you just wonder, I don't know. I don't see what they – I mean, they probably got some cash for him is all they got. It's just – I don't know.
The Red Sox?
Interesting. No, the Kansas City.
Maybe the Yankees liked him and they wanted – they didn't just want to take him from the Red Sox, so they needed Kansas City to take him and trade him, you know, kind of because they can't take from the Red – they can't admit that they like the Red Sox player better.
Well, it's probably more that they didn't think he'd last to their pick too.
True. Would be my guess. Could have been, yeah.
So. Here's a hypothetical Rule 5 question. Mm-hmm. The Rule 5 – the draft was instituted a while back when I think the minimum salary in the majors was around $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also the cost. That's how much it costs to take a player in the Rule 5 draft if you have to return that player. So if that price escalated with inflation and was like $440,000 today, do you think these teams would be taking flyers on players like this?
Well, especially not now that they added a year.
Right, well, yeah.
So how long it takes you to... I mean, as it is right now, Rule 5 is basically...
It's basically done.
Yeah, it's useless at this point. I mean, everybody talks about the Santanas and Uglas and whatnot, but, you know, those guys, you know, if they have another year to develop, they definitely get protected the following year, right? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, I think that I saw that the stat, which is the best player who has been taken in the Rule 5 draft since they pushed it back a year, has been Darren O'Day. So,
Which, yeah...
Says it all.
No, yeah. For $440,000 or $450,000, I don't think they'd be taking flyers. No way.
No, it's because then it's like $25,000 to take a guy back. Just like, yeah, of course, you know.
Right.
But what impediment is that? But
right, exactly.
At any rate, just a couple of things. You know, real quick, I don't know if this really merits discussion, but obviously the signing of Kelly Shopik has happened since the last podcast. That likely means Ryan LaVarnway is starting AAA. I don't think that's a surprise to any of us. I don't know if is there anything worth talking about on that? I mean, you know, if someone's hurt, maybe he starts the year in the majors, but I don't think that's anything surprising there. And then I guess just merits mentioning real quick is the kind of morass of pitchers now that have quote-unquote signed minor league deals to compete for a start in the rotation this spring. Among them, Vicente Padilla, Aaron Cook, Carlos Silva. I mean, over under on number of innings pitched in AAA among those guys, I put it maybe 20.
Yeah. I mean, can we
agree on this?
Yeah. They're having just, open tryouts right now.
Yeah, it's tryouts. It's you sign a guy to a minor league deal to bring him into camp. I can't see any of those guys pitching in Pawtucket past April. It's kind of like the situation with Denny Reyes last year where, yeah, he was on a minor league deal, but he wasn't going to pitch in AAA at any point.
It makes spring training a little bit more fun, though, than it has been in the past couple of years. You know, we've kind of been debating over who's going to be the last spot in the bullpen, which that's fun to debate, I guess. But now maybe there's a little bit more excitement, and we'll see, you know, guys competing in the outfield situation. So it'll be an interesting spring training, I think, at the very least.
Yeah, I said that in a new feature we've added to the news page. You guys should all check it out as First Take, where we respond to moves as they happen. And one thing I mentioned in the first one is that this really seems like it's going to be one of the more open spring trainings that they've had in a while, especially in terms of the pitching staff. I mean, if you look at it, the only spots that are hammered down are the top three starters, Bard and Aceves and whatever role they're in, Bailey and Melanson. And at that point, you've probably got four spots that are up for grabs. I mean, Morales and Albers probably have inside shots at a couple of them, but if they get severely outpitched, I could see them being dropped. You know, it's unlikely, but there's at least two spots, and then, you know, trying to figure out who's pitching where. So it'll be interesting to see how that works. But anyway, moving on. The next topic we wanted to talk about, you know, this is the time of year where everybody's releasing their prospect lists, and, you know, a guy who's been our top prospect since... When did we elevate? July?
July-ish, maybe.
July-ish sounds
about right. Before the trade deadline?
Yeah, at the very least. Will Middlebrooks is now more or less emerging. Maybe not the consensus top prospect, but the majority's pick as the top prospect in the system. We know the book on him more or less by now. You know, very good defense at third base. Strong arm. Hits for power. Strikes out a lot, has come a long, long way from when he first entered the system when he had that abysmal campaign in Lowell, more or less. I mean, I think that's a fair way to put it. What we were discussing kind of behind the scenes is just what do we have now in Will Middlebrooks? What can we expect from him? You know, you hear top prospect and everybody kind of assumes, you know, top prospect equals future all-star, you know, future...
Hall of Famer, future
Kevin Youkilis, future Dustin Pedroia, future Clay Buchholz or John Lester, which isn't necessarily fair. You know, it could also mean future Lars Anderson if you have a weak system. Although at the time he was kind of considered to be a future All Star, but that's a discussion for another day. What I wanted to know from you guys, I guess we'll start with the first question: is just not ceiling, not floor. What do you think fans can expect to get out of Will Middlebrooks at the major league level when he's there for good, which I guess realistically we can say is next spring, 2013, full time. I guess just to start with maybe we'll start with Ian and then we'll get Chris's take. What do you see him as at the major league level?
I see him as providing, he will provide good defense, and I hope for average offense. I'm so reticent about him kind of relates to Matt Dominguez, the Marlins third base prospect, another guy who he's known for having the best glove at third base in the minors. And he was basically written into the third base position for the Marlins last year. Mm-hmm. And he just couldn't hit at all in spring training. He didn't make it. He took a step back last season in the minors, and he had his prospect status is basically diminished. And something he always struggled with in the minors was adjusting. He took very long to adjust. Another concern I have for Miller, where if these a player who takes a long time to develop at each level, is that an indication of maybe just not being as prodigious as we thought? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Melon? Do you have concerns about him as well, or?
I have concerns about every minor league prospect. So I mean, that's why I have concerns about everybody. You know, I can find fault with all of them and point out a lot of flaws. But I thought he adjusted pretty well in Double A. He started off. I don't know what his April numbers are, but I think he started off pretty strong in April. Maybe started tearing down in May, and then picked it back up in the summer months. So I'm not. I know people point at the strikeouts, and it's just it's interesting watching him because he hits the ball hard frequently. He's always on the ball, a lot of line drives, and when he started kind of just getting the feeling that he can muscle a ball out to right field and he can drive a ball 440 feet into the right center field gap, he's a really good hitter for about 8 straight weeks there in Double A right before he got promoted to Triple A. It was every ball was on the screws, either up the middle to right center field, left field, and I think he's just kind of starting to feel out what he is, and he's learning his strike zone. And yeah, is he gonna walk 100 times? I don't think so. Could he walk some kind of profile and maybe he strikes out 115 times, walks 60 times? I think he can. As you learn more about yourself as a hitter and kind of understand and get that confidence, and then, he's got the natural raw talent, I think that he can have some above-average seasons offensively at the major league level.
One thing that I notice a lot about Middlebrooks is he's the type of guy that the numbers don't necessarily bear out the love that scouts have for him. I can recall being at a Portland game this past summer where I was in the box with a scout that I don't know if he hadn't seen the Sox in a while or not, but this was when Middlebrooks was still on the disabled list just before he went down to Lowell for his rehab assignment. So he was taking batting practice in like a shell, not in the warm-up jersey. So he didn't have a number on. And the scout asked me, just kind of in awe, watching him take batting practice, who is that? Just kind of in the sort of like ooh-la-la sort of way, clearly just, very interested in what he was seeing. And I told him, it was Middlebrooks. And it just seems like he's a guy that scouts love, but that, that a lot of the concerns over him are more about the numbers, but look at how many times he strikes out. He still strikes. I mean, his K rate last year was 25%, I think, if I could probably look that up. But, I mean, Melon is kind of our, scout. I mean, how do you kind of reconcile those two things, the numbers versus what you see in person?
I think he has the tools that you look for. And I know Ian can chime in too. He has major league bat speed. And we saw that in Lowell, even as he had that abysmal campaign, as you described it. I mean, he'd hit shots there and balls with backspin that, the sound of the bat was different. The sound of the bat was different than every single player that was on that field. And as Ian likes to say a lot of times, Middlebrooks looked like the best player on the field by the end of the season in Lowell, even though he hit, 250 with one home run. He has those skills, and I think that the thinking is that he's a hard worker. He's focused on baseball. He's got that that intangible. He's got that makeup that you look for, and you kind of think, okay, he's 23. When he gets to he's going to learn. He's going to keep learning and getting better at, you know, so when he's 27 to 32 years old, he's going to have his best seasons, you know, in the majors.
But you can look like the best player on Lowell and still kind of have the potential to be an average major leaguer. Does he look like I haven't seen him in Double A. I haven't seen. So does he look like the best player on a Double A team?
He looked like the best overall player on Portland. I mean, when LaVarnway was in the lineup and Middlebrooks was there, I mean, those were the 1-2 guys. Those were the guys. LaVarnway was just kind of, by the time he got promoted to Triple A, was so far ahead of Double A that he was just hitting everything all over the field. But Middlebrooks had it. I mean, it was Manny Benuelos pitched against Portland. LaVarnway was still there, and it was the first time through the order. And then, so the first two times through the order, the two people who hit the ball the hardest were LaVarnway and Middlebrooks, and everybody else was flaring, either striking out or hitting, you know, weak grounders or pop-ups. I mean, LaVarnway hit a rocket base hit to right field, and Middlebrooks hit one on the screws right at the right fielder in their first at-bat. So those were the only two guys who even really made any type of solid contact against Benuelos in his first four innings. And to me, Benuelos is a major league pitcher. So that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the guys who can handle the top talent and look like they're the guys who are going to be able to project at the major league level. And I know we would agree on LaVarnway that, you know, he was head and shoulders above there. And you kind of see that he's going to be a major league hitter. So with Benuelos, yeah, I mean, he looked, out of that whole Portland team, from start to finish, he was the number one guy on that team.
Yeah, I can attest to at least BP when he was there, because he didn't play in the game. And granted, at that point, I mean, with all due respect to the players that were in Portland this year, there were mainly because of injuries too. You know, that lineup was really kind of banged up at some points. You know, they basically had to go out and sign Ryan Corey to play shortstop for them just because they were so banged up. But at the games I was at in Manchester, his batting practice was just not even close to anybody else's. And this was after, no, Chang was still there, actually. So even with the season that Ian's boy, Chi-Sun Chang, had, which was just, you know, at one point, I mean, he was just locked in more than anyone we've had in the system in a while, it seemed like, with the exception of probably LaVarnway when he got to Pawtucket. Middlebrooks' batting practice, just, it sounded different, it looked different. You know, it was pretty obvious why that scout, you know, asked me who that guy was. So there is that element to him still. So I guess, you know, I know, Melon, you absolutely loathe doing this, but what I want to ask you guys for now is, you know, if you were to gun to your head MLB comp for Middlebrooks, you know, who would you say and why? I guess I'll start with Ian, because you're not quite so loath to do this exercise, but what player? Because this is part of what our discussion has been behind the scenes.
Well, I think I've said before, and I'll still say, Joe Creedy seems to be kind of the someone who I would be happy with him being, and I think it's a reasonable expectation.
And just, but what in particular? Like,
oh well, Creedy was a guy who kind of a low OBP, like a fairly above average slugging guy and excellent defense at third base. And his career ended prematurely because of a back injury. But I think he was a guy I actually always appreciated, because really just a fantastic guy to watch at third. Really, really fun to watch play defense. And if Middlebrooks provides the same entertainment playing third and is an average bat, you know, maybe that's better for a 95 win team, but I think I'll be happy with it.
So Creedy for his career was 254, 304, 444 slash line. His best season was probably 06. He won the Silver Slugger and was 283 average, 323 on base, 506 slugging. So is that the kind of player you're seeing?
Yeah, that's kind of. I think that's a good baseline.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, Creedy also made an All-Star game in 2008. So, you know, just because he's a guy who didn't necessarily have a Hall of Fame career, that's no slouch. How about you, Melon? What comes to mind when you kind of compare Middlebrooks?
I like the Ian's Creedy comp when he mentioned it. Creedy, though, had better bat control, didn't strike out quite as much as I would expect Middlebrooks to strike out at the major league. I think Creedy struck out under 100 times every season of his career. I mean, if he struck out more than 100 times, it was just a little bit, just by a little bit, and he was a power guy. So I think Creedy has better bat control in that aspect. I'm not quite sure why Creedy didn't walk that much at the major league level. He probably just swung it. He probably just had such good bat control. Most of the stuff he swung at, he hit, and he didn't always hit it hard. Probably that's why his batting average was low. So I've also heard I've heard poor man's Jeff Zimmerman is one comp that's been tossed at me from people.
Ryan Zimmerman?
Ryan Zimmerman. I'm sorry. Poor man's Ryan Zimmerman. Travis Fryman has been thrown back at me from a couple guys asking me, you know, saying that their management, their higher ups have mentioned Fryman with Middlebrooks or Zimmerman. That's kind of where I'm at.
Can I just this kind of will segue without leaving the conversation, but into a conversation we'll have later. But I think what just happened was so fascinating. So we were talking about Middlebrooks, and Chris is higher on him than me, I think, is apparent. I'm not down on him, but I think I have lower expectations than most. I throw out a comp, and Chris thinks he's going to be worse than the comp. I think he's going to be better than the comp. So what does that say about the way we look at comps, right?
I hate them, personally, but I understand their utility. You know, it's just so hard to shoehorn a guy in, but... You know, everyone always asks, oh, who's he going to be at the major league level? It's like, well, you know, the guy might not, you know, what's the comp for Lars Anderson at this point? You know,
because when I say comp, like, if I wanted a comp for a player, it would be someone like, who does he look like? Not look like physically, but who, like, which player's game is he reminiscent of, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think another perfectly reasonable interpretation of comp is whose career is he going to have?
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at it as.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Whose career? Yeah. I was thinking with the strikeouts, you know, Creedy was a very, very low strikeout guy. I think Middlebrooks is going to strike out, but I think he consistently hits the ball harder than Creedy did. Creedy was more of a dead pull hitter who tried to yank the ball, and he would roll over a lot of balls and put a lot more weak contact in the play. But when he'd hit enough home runs and extra base hits to drive his slugging percentage up, but, you know, just thinking of the way hitters are, you know, if you think a guy doesn't strike out a ton, but yet he maintains a lower batting average. And I understand people think batting average is luck and there's factors, but if you're always hitting the ball hard, you know, more or less, if you hit the ball hard in the play, you're going to maintain a higher batting average because you're hitting line drives and you hit the ball hard. So that is just kind of the way it goes. So it's interesting on Creedy that he was a low strikeout guy, but a low batting average guy. And then with Middlebrooks, I think he could maintain a high enough batting average with more strikeouts because when he hits the ball, he drills it.
All right. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, while we're talking about player comps and things like that, let's segue into our next topic, which is Xander Bogaerts, who, you know, if you're going to pick another guy to be the top prospect in the system, he seems to be the runner up that also gets a couple of first place votes. This is another guy behind the scenes that we've also been talking about what's his projection at the major league level, which is, since he's so much farther away, there's so much more variability. We don't even know what position he's going to play in the majors yet, to be honest. There are few who think that he has a better than 50% chance of sticking at shortstop. What do you guys think? I guess we'll start with Mellon first on this. As far as Xander Bogaerts goes, maybe start with the comp, and then what can we expect out of him at the majors?
Well, if he makes the majors, what can we expect out of him? I'll go. So start on offense. The power's there. I think even you know how the Salem Bar ballpark is in the Carolina League is. He may not show quite as much power as he did in Greenville. So you know he could definitely see a drop off. Given you know the walls in Salem are so high, I never seen minor league walls that are that high. So he may lose some home runs, and the pitchers are a little bit better. But the power is raw power, probably 70, I'd say plus raw power, and I project him out at about be able to produce 60 to 65 type of power. That's you're talking between 25 and 30 home runs, I think 25 and 35 home runs. For Bogaerts, I mean, the power is undeniable for him, even at this young age. Hitting-wise, when you look at him offensively, he does a lot of good things for a hitter his age. He's really raw approach-wise, discipline-wise, and pitch recognition. So that's going to be, you know, what he's going to really have to learn. And that's why he's difficult to project, because I know, Ian, we were throwing around behind the scenes Adrian Beltre. And that was kind of your comp. And you look at Beltre, I mean, Beltre's hit as high as 334 in the major leagues, and he hit 321 with the Red Sox. I was looking at his numbers, and he's a 276 career hitter, which puts him at about a 55 on the scale, right? About solid average for batting average. Mm-hmm. But if his hit tool, I mean, to hit 334 in the majors, 324, he hit 290 something last year, and he doesn't strike out a lot again, like we talked about with Creed. He's got a great hit tool, Beltre.
Yeah,
what's
his average without his career in Seattle, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he hit 48 home runs with LA, so if you said throw those home runs out, then throw out his season at 8, and he's like a 25, 26 career average home run hitter.
Yeah, just so to give it, he was 274 before he went to Seattle, so that would have been with the Dodgers.
Okay.
So. Okay.
He's really had like a very bipolar career. I mean, he's had some unbelievable seasons, and then he's just been one of the worst players in baseball. I guess you can't say that because his defense has always been great, but one of the worst offensive players in baseball.
Well, I mean, OPS plus is a really crude tool, but I mean, he's had OPS plus years of 88 and 83. So,
right.
I mean, and then in other years, he's well above 100. I mean, it's funny, his year in Boston was by far, or not by far his best, his second best, because his best was that year he was the runner-up in the MVP voting in 04.
Mm-hmm.
So he really, I mean, because he had that rag on him for a while of not being, you know, of performing only in a contract year. But, of course, 09 kind of kicked that one aside.
And last year.
This past year he wasn't bad.
He was great this year.
He was good.
Yeah, he was great. Well, I'm saying like he wasn't good in his Seattle walk year.
Yeah, right? Right.
So I think he was hurt too, right?
Right.
Yeah, he was dinged up. Well, he was hurt the whole time he was with Seattle, it felt like.
So I think also one of the reasons why it's hard to comp to Adrian Beltre is because a lot of people have speculated that since he really, I mean, I think he broke into the majors at what, 19?
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that's actually, he was a year younger than he said. He was the opposite. You know how age gate, you lie about your age?
Fausto Carmona yesterday.
Right. So he lied the other way because he was 15 and he wanted to get signed. This is Beltre. He wanted to get signed when he was 15, so he lied to actually be older.
Mm. Wow.
It's one of the rare cases that's happened. But he went to the minors so quickly that he has some, as we've seen, insane idiosyncrasies. Like, I don't think you can compare anyone to Adrian Beltre, the way he feels or hits.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
That type of power. You know, if you look at
so
Beltre's
power
profile, that power definitely.
Right.
But you wonder, you know, but Beltre, I think he has a really, really high level of talent when it comes to his natural hit tool. So you're looking at Bogaerts, and I'm not quite sure he has that hit tool. Does it? Can he be more consistent with his production over the course of a major league season? Over the course of a career, I think absolutely, because Bogaerts is going to get a chance to learn the strike zone, learn his strike zone in the minor leagues. He's going to get a chance to develop his pitch recognition. I just said Beltre was pushed so quickly to the majors that he almost kind of like had to survive with the way he hits. He didn't have a chance to really learn, and he learned at the major league level, but he didn't have a chance to really kind of develop a profile as a hitter. And you know, Beltre's not very disciplined, but he has a good approach. He goes the other way a lot, and he hits the ball from right field line to left field line. So he's got a pretty good approach. And when he's approaching the plate, you know, when he's approaching his at-bats, looking all over the field, it's okay that he's not super selective because he's got that great hit tool and the ability to put the barrel on the ball, and he just hits rockets all over the field. So it's an interesting comp. I thought it was interesting, you know, just on the offensive profile. But, you know, we'll develop more as we see.
Well, to give you an example of how advanced he was, in his age 17, which I guess you could say was his age 18 season, if that's a true story, which old Bogaerts was this year, if I'm correct, right? He was 18?
Yep.
Yep.
In low A, Beltre had basically 1,000 OPS for the season.
You mean high A?
No, low A. He split the season between high A and low A.
his 17. Okay. Yeah, sorry. What site are you looking at right now?
Baseball Reference.
I am too. Okay. So the number on there says 17. You're saying he was at that point 16 or
18?
Oh.
Because he was a year younger. He's a year younger than he actually claims to be.
So then he should have been 16.
18.
No. He's younger. That says 17. If he's younger than that, he would have been 16.
No, he is younger than that.
Okay.
He's a year younger than that.
Yeah, so he would have been 16 because it says 17.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Because, hold on. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, year younger would have meant he'd be 16 in Savannah hitting 307, 406,
yes,
586.
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad you're going to edit that part out.
Says who? I might shorten it. Yeah, we'll see.
I confused myself. All right, you're right. So that's crazy. 16?
Even 17, that's crazy.
Even 17, yeah.
So, yeah.
Anyway, Adrian Beltre, great player. What were we talking about again?
Xander Bogaerts.
His projection.
Yeah.
To comp, yeah. You know, what are you expecting?
Yeah, I mean, just to lightning round, what comp would you throw out there for him? And where do you think he'll even end up?
I think third base seems like a good middle ground.
Who does?
Third base seems like a, you mean what team or what position?
No, position.
Yeah,
position.
I think third base seems like a good half bet between right field and shortstop.
Okay.
I don't know. A comp, like we said, they're so nebulous, but Aramis Ramirez, I don't know. A power hitting right handed third baseman.
Hmm. How about you, Melon Baller?
Yeah, I'll go with that's a good comp of power hitting right handed third baseman. I like that.
I
think that'll be the position wise, it's really gonna be it's interesting. I think the quicker the Red Sox move him off shortstop, that kind of signals that they're, you know, thinking about him in their longer term plans. I know I was thinking about this. You know, we watch, like, they keep guys at positions for a long time, and we say, oh, it's their, you know, the Red Sox are trying to get them to the majors and all that kind of good stuff. But they also want other teams to see them play in those positions so that they can sell them off if they have to and get a team to buy high on them at that position. So if you think about, I know Hanley Ramirez pushed Pedroia off shortstop, but they moved Pedroia over to second base in AA. And that was like, that's the kind of the time when they were preparing him to be their major leaguer. So I'll be interested to see with Bogaerts, if the quicker they move him off shortstop, I think that's a signal that they're kind of looking more towards their long-term plans. If he gets up to AA and even AAA playing shortstop, and it's kind of apparent that he isn't a shortstop, I think they're just keeping him there to kind of keep his value.
Well, to me, it seems like he's not even a bad. Like, he's like if you watch him play shortstop now, you'd be like, oh, he's a good shortstop. It's really about the projection in the future where his body is going that you're like, there's no way.
Right. And he's not a bad shortstop by any means, and he's got very good skills. He just doesn't have that elite type of defensive talent where you're like, okay, that's a major league shortstop in the future. He's just a little bit below that. And I think as they age and I mean, you got 30 big league shortstops, and out of those, how many are legit? Maybe 20 of them are legit shortstops. So it's a very, very, very select and premium position.
Mm-hmm. All right, one final thing we want to hit on now that we've wrapped that up. This past week, Yes, it was this past week, I was able to head to the New Stars for Young Stars fundraiser at Jillian's Boston. And it's the 7th annual event fundraiser for the Jimmy Fund, and obviously a lot of minor leaguers present to sign autographs, meet some of the kids that are helped by the Jimmy Fund, and obviously we got to talk to them as well. And we're trying something new here. We're going to try and splice in some audio that I got from the event. In case that doesn't work, I'm going to also read these guys the quotes I got from these players to get their reactions really quick from them. First off, the first player I talked to, I just want to get your comments on this because this was one of the ones that actually drew reaction from Ian when I emailed you guys what I got from the event. Was Alex Wilson, obviously a starting pitcher, was the minor league pitcher of the year for the Red Sox this past season. And I asked him about his off-season routine, and this is what he had to say.
And as far as preparation for the season, what's your off-season routine at this point? I know I read some interesting stuff you've been doing this off-season.
Yeah, the beginning of the off-season was a little different. I was working at Lowe's every morning, mm-hmm. but now it's I've kind of hung that up, and I've moved on to and committed myself to being really serious about getting ready for ball. And right now, I wake up every morning about 7, eat breakfast, and then I go run and work out and throw and do that kind of stuff. And when I get back home from this trip is when I'm going to start getting off the mound and preparing that way, too. Mm-hmm.
According to an article in the Pawtucket Times from the Hot Stove event in Pawtucket the night before, he was working at Lowe's from 5 a.m. to about noon or 1, stocking shelves. Ian, since you were the one that found this so interesting, what are your thoughts on the Red Sox minor league pitcher of the year spending his mornings at Lowe's?
When you emailed that to me, I think that was kind of late at night / early morning. I had to do I had to triple take because I kept on rereading it, and I'm like, "There's no way that's true." I mean, this is not
if it
Shannon
worked
Walker.
For Kurt, like, if it worked for Kurt Warner.
But yeah, I think it makes sense. Like, it makes sense for a minor leaguer to do that. But not someone who's like straddling the major league AAA. I mean, hey, listen, if it's what he needs to do, it's what he needs to do. I'm not trying to say I'm not trying to denigrate his situation. I'm just saying, to me, that's mind blowing that major leaguers in this basically major leaguers still have second jobs in this day and age. That's I thought that went out with like the 40s, 50s.
Well, remember too, is he was drafted as basically a senior. I mean. Was he a senior or a junior? I mean,
he
had a redshirt season when he transferred when he didn't pitch when he also had Tommy John, but I mean his bonus I checked it wasn't that big. He didn't get $1 million or anything like that, even though he was drafted where he was.
He got like $100,000, I think.
He got let me check this. He got I mean it wasn't enormous. It wasn't like
no,
you
know, I
know. A mil.
I mean, dude, but maybe he likes retail. I mean, yes. I don't know. I'm not gonna judge. But
yeah. I mean, in his quotes in the Pawtucket Times, he got $470K.
That's good money.
That's good money.
Send it my way.
Especially for second round pick. But also, I mean, he mentioned in there that he's got a house mm-hmm. in West Virginia, in his native Hurricane, West Virginia. I don't know. I just found that really interesting that
place to buy a house.
Yeah, I know, right? But a top 20 prospect in the system is...
Yeah, he'll be in the majors next year. At some point, he will be in the majors next year. That's my prediction for the new year.
Don't go too far out on a limb there. Dominant in Pawtucket and 4 starts last year, and you're predicting he's going to make the majors at some point. That's ballsy. All right, anyway, moving along. Coburn Vidic, who, as I mentioned in my article about my talk with him this week, looked like he jumped straight out of a GQ magazine, rocking a skinny tie and gold tie clip. But anyway, he mentioned his defense at third base. Said the following.
One of the things we've seen you doing, you know, pre-game, during games, everything, every stop you've done so far is working on the D at third.
Yep.
Something, I mean, a lot more than we've seen a lot of other guys putting the work in there.
Yeah.
How's that coming along at this point? How comfortable are you? And
it's coming along really well, man. Last year was a big stepping stone for me. You know, the first half of the season compared to the second half, you know, I felt like I made major improvements. And, you know, it's just about getting that repetition in and getting more comfortable with the position. But, you know, I'm feeling great there, and I'm feeling a lot more comfortable. And, you know, going into this year, I'll be a lot more confident with it. And, you know, I'm looking forward to getting back after it.
And later on, I talked to him, and he added that in his plans and goals for the year, one specific one he mentioned was to get to Portland in AA, which, okay, he probably should start there. But the other thing he mentioned was to continue playing third base and just be an everyday player there, which is not something you necessarily hear a lot from a lot of guys in the system. So he knows that. It seems like he knows his future may or may not be at third. What are your guys' thoughts on that as a player, kind of knowing that, you know, he needs to keep working at a position and knowing that he may have to move off there in the future if he isn't able to maybe hack it at that position?
Well, I think that, you know, he has the right attitude mm-hmm. about it, but he's not a butcher at third base, but... he's just not very instinctive, and he doesn't react well to the to the balls and his ankles. And you'd think he's a pretty good athlete. He's got a lean body type. He's got some speed. Pretty strong arm, but when he's over at third base, he just doesn't look like – he looks like a fish out of water. And he short arms the ball when he tries to throw from third base, and he loses some steam on his throws, and they tend to dip. And as a former pitcher, a guy who was clocked up in, I don't know, in the low 90s, Ian, when he was pitching. Mm-hmm. I remember Middlebrooks was clocked off the mound when he was in high school at 91-ish. I mean, his arm's a cannon from third base. And Vidic, I mean, it didn't look like a guy who could tune it up to 91, 92 miles an hour, in my opinion. I thought the arm was rather fringy for a third baseman. But I know he's got a strong arm. It's just kind of like he's all out of whack, and he's not very natural with the way he throws on the run and things like that. But I think that, I mean, I can't see him as a major league third baseman, and as a triple A third baseman, I don't think so either. You know, maybe double A, he plays some third base and keeps going. But I mean, his defense is just fringe average, maybe even a little bit below that.
You know, it's interesting too. I mean, he kind of got moved around a bit at Ball State too, because his freshman year he was predominantly a DH or first baseman. His sophomore year he was a third baseman, and then as a junior, because he was also their Friday starter, they played him at second base, in part at least to save his arm for when he pitched. But
right.
You know, I'm sure that hasn't helped him at all either.
Yeah, that hasn't helped him.
But like you said, I mean, he's got the right attitude about it, and I mentioned in the piece on the news page, you know, if you went to batting practice, you saw him off to the side taking extra ground balls, which, you know, compared to, say, another third baseman that may have been on the Salem roster at that time that I'm on record as not being very much of a fan of his work ethic, Michael Almanzar, you know, it's the right attitude to have where he's at least working
Who?
At it. Who? What?
Who?
Did I say anybody?
I didn't hear it.
Michael Almanzar.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, you see, it's comparing that to just loafing through stretches and everything like that. It's you know, it's interesting. But anyway, moving on. Garen Caccini, a guy who really seemed to be starting to get hot last year before he you know, kind of his season ended with a wrist injury. He said the wrist is fine now. He said part of the game to get over having multiple injuries, but. He also said this about playing third base, because he's moving to third base as well.
And then you were a shortstop when you were drafted, moving over to third base. How's that transition going?
It's doing great. You know, it's definitely challenging. You know, I've never played third in my life, mm-hmm. So you got to get the angles right. You got to learn how to play balls. You got to learn how to do stuff like you can't play balls like you did at shortstop. You know, so I've worked. I feel like I've worked tremendously hard this offseason with trying to get better at third base, mm-hmm. And hopefully it's going to pay dividends this next season.
Just kind of interesting to hear him kind of talk about moving and reacting at third base as well. He also kind of same, you know, learning to play pro ball and figuring things out as a rookie, learning to be a professional, slowing the game down type stuff. I don't know. I think he's definitely a player to watch this year. He's probably got as much helium as anybody in the system for this coming season for me. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, I believe in the bet. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Melon, what were your thoughts about him at third base when you got to see him?
Well, he's not very good at third base, but that's just due to lack of experience. He has the natural skills to be a good third baseman, and I think as he said in that quote, he's just learning how to slow the game down and the angles and things like that. You know, he'll get the reactions. He looked, you know, similar to when Will Middlebrooks moved over to third base early in his career. He wasn't very good there either. And he was slow, but you could see that he had the skills and it was there. It just, you know, it takes some time to build that repetition and move yourself up the chain, mm-hmm. to continue to get better at the position. And I think that, you know, most shortstops, you know, most former shortstops who can move over to third base, I mean, I don't think that they should become, you know, at least better than average, you know, maybe solid average type third baseman. I don't think that the position, I don't think the position is as demanding as shortstop, obviously. And if you can play a shortstop, maybe not in the minor leagues is anything better than Friend's average. I think you can play shortstop, third base, you know, you can develop it and become a good defender there.
And this is talking about moving up the ladder and everything like that. One player we saw do that this year was Brandon Jacobs. I got the chance to ask him about becoming a full-time baseball player as opposed to an athlete that plays both football and baseball. This is what he had to say.
Just to start off, one thing we really heard about the year you had last year is you really started to look in a lot of ways, both physique-wise and field-wise, like a true baseball player as opposed to an athlete who does baseball and football. Was that something that you were mindful of and preparing for the season or your development at all, or is it just something that happened with committing to the sport?
I think it during my off season, you know, it's a thing that I, you know, I really tried to do, and you know, didn't, you know, all the heavy weights, let them go, you know, just pretty much trying to get in shape. And, you know, lose a couple pounds, you know, baseball, you know, getting the speed, especially playing the outfield. And, you know, going through a full season will definitely, you know, shape your body right. You know, you're doing two workouts a week during the season, you know, it's nothing overpowering. And just some cardio just to get in shape, get the physique of a baseball player now and get the football thing in the past.
And he also mentioned later on wanting to get his arm in shape and that he's doing long toss and kind of recognizes that his arm, you know, was maybe the weak part of his defensive game last year, that he liked the speed he had in the outfield getting to balls, but he didn't really like where his arm was. So he's trying to work that into shape, too. Mellon, just talking about the conversion of a football player to a baseball player, what he had to go through. Mellon, you said he looked like a completely different player than he was in Lowell, I believe.
He did. He looked a lot less stiff. And you could tell that, as he said, that he cut back on the heavy lifting. You know, there's probably no reason for him to be in the gym benching 350 pounds anymore, like a running back would, or working squats till he drops dead. There's no reason to kind of do those kind of things anymore. It's all about, you know, getting your lean muscle. And, you know, as he talks about with his arm, he's a strong guy, but when you're muscle bound up in your shoulders and chest, and as you can lose that muscle and tone up the muscle and get it to be a little bit more leaner, you can get some more arm strength out of it. Because it's not that he's weak, it's just that his arm was so probably tight from being a football player that he's got to loosen it up and kind of get, you know, all his body working together.
How about Ian, what do you think about as far as, you know, going from being a football running back to being a left fielder? I mean, how long do we expect that conversion to take a guy before we really know what he is, in your opinion?
We should probably know by, I would think, this year. I think if we don't already know, to me, he seems like he's going to be a left fielder in the future, probably an average defensive left fielder. I think the thing that always kind of amazes me about the transition from either baseball to football or vice versa is how some things just don't translate like you expect them to. I think I was listening to another podcast recently. I think it was Kevin Goldstein's podcast. And they were just giving out all these examples of really, really fast football players who were in the minor leagues, just like we're talking, like, you know, receiver, cornerback fast, who were just not fast. They were average base runners at best. I'm not talking about, like, base running instincts. I'm talking about base running speed. And intuitively, there's just no reason behind that. You'd think you'd be able to get away on pure athleticism for, you know, just in speed, but for whatever reason, it just does not translate for some people. I'm always amazed by that.
Interesting. That's interesting. I mean, especially because Jacobs was a guy that we saw steal a bunch of bases last year that, you know, while he was a running back, it wasn't like he was a scat back or anything like that. I mean, he was a big dude.
I don't think his speed's going to, you know, continue to follow him up with each step. As he gets close, if he can continue to get himself closer and closer, I don't think speed's going to be part of his game. Mm-hmm. I mean, he might steal he might be able to steal on judgment and kind of catching other teams from surprise and using a little bit of speed. But, like, you know, 10-ish stolen bases. I know what did he steal, 20-something last year? And you know, I don't see him being able to steal that many at the major league level. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a situation where he was running and catchers can't throw these days, and no one can hold anybody on base when it comes to Greenville. They don't even look over a lot of times. So,
mm-hmm. Well, the last player I spoke to at New Stars was another Greenville guy, and Sean Coyle. Among the things I talked to him about, first off, he wanted to clear something up. I hadn't realized it. He got hit with a pitch in the face last year. He has a couple of fake teeth and broke his jaw and missed 10 games. So I found that interesting that he only missed 10 games. It could have been a lot more serious than that. Fractured his jaw, actually. But he wanted to clear up that he didn't. There was a story out that he had actually bunted a ball into his face. But he actually got just hit with a pitch. The other thing I got to ask him about that was interesting was about the power he showed last year, and he had this to say.
One thing we saw from last year, they usually say power is one of the last things that comes with the prospect moving up to the majors. But, I mean, you had more extra base hits than singles last year. The power was there. Was that something you expected, or was it just kind of run into some good pitches?
I think I got some good pitches, and I got a hold of some good pitches. You know, I put some good swings on some balls. But, I guess I didn't know how power numbers would really be affected coming out of high school. And, you know, I'd never really taken a full season and just accumulated all my stats and really looked at them. You know, pretty much in high school and everything, you play every day, and then no one really keeps a stat sheet the summer, and you just go, and then it's the next year. So, I mean, to actually have a sample of a, like, statistical spreadsheet or something, I'm out there, I'm not trying to hit home runs, you know, it's just, you get under a ball here or there, you know, and just kind of happens, yeah.
About the power we saw from him last year, is that something that maybe we can expect to continue seeing? What do you guys think? Start with Ian.
Yeah, I buy into his power. I think there's the Pedroia comparisons are almost too obvious, but from the way Chris describes him, you know, very, very stocky, almost strong base.
He's got big old forearms too. Yeah, you notice that shaking his hand.
I don't know. I like him. I like him a lot. I think I like a lot of players in that Greenville team, but I think to me he sticks out as probably the prospect from that I'm going to watch going into the season the most.
Mm-hmm.
Other than Bogarts.
Okay, yeah. Good save.
Thank you.
Melon.
I like Coyle. I think he's a solid prospect. I'm not quite as high on him as some others seem to be. I think there's definite separation between him and Garin Tocchini in terms of the type of prospects they are. I don't think he has that type of ceiling. I think he has the ceiling of an everyday major leaguer, but I don't see him as beyond that. You know, everyday second baseman and major league regular would be his ceiling. You know, but I think it's something that, I don't know, the power he is very his calves are huge. He's got a huge lower body. You know, much different build than Dustin Pedroia. You know, he's a much different player in my opinion, and he's got a shorter swing. Real compact swing, and he gets a lot of backspin, and I can see him, you know, I could see him being a 40 plus doubles player, you know, in the big leagues in a season. He could definitely hit 40 plus doubles. I'm not sure what type of home run numbers. I kind of peg his home run power as average, you know, 12-ish home runs, but as we've seen with other players, you know, that's not always the case. You know, projections are just that, projections, but. You know, I like him. I just don't. I think, you know, he's not in that Bogarts, Cecchini, Swihart type class for me.
Mm-hmm. One thing I also had cleared up. I don't know whether this was just me not knowing what I was talking about or not, but I thought that he played shortstop mostly in high school. But it turned out, I guess, his senior year he played mostly shortstop. But before then, he had played about. He told me 60-40 second base instead of shortstop because his brother, who's actually a shortstop at UNC right now. Was the primary shortstop when they were growing up. So I found that interesting because we'd heard that both him and Cecchini were guys who were drafted as shortstops that were going to move, and I guess maybe technically they were, but with Coyle it was more that, you know, he was a second baseman that had played shortstop as a senior rather than, you know, in Cecchini's case where he was a shortstop who was always a shortstop that moved to third for the first time. So very interesting. But that'll about do it. Do you guys have any parting shots? Anything you want to get in there before we wrap this up as El Chombo leads us out?
I have one quick thing.
All right, throw it out.
You, Chris Hatfield, you always talk about how the Red Sox are so good at manipulating service time.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Darnell McDonald, 2 days away from arbitration.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Very nice.
So,
very, very nice.
Yeah.
Had not noticed that. So, that's it. I mean... It's interesting.
That's a Rob Bradford note, by the way, to give credit.
That's pretty good.
2 days. Wow, that's even better. What was it with Manny Del Carmen? 8 days?
I think it was like, yeah. He's always the guy. He's the other guy who I use as the example for that.
Wow, that's... Well, but, I mean, with McDonald, is that even on purpose, though?
I don't know. He was in the minors both this year and last year. I mean, who knows? I don't know. I'm sure
he wasn't in the minors this year, was he? I thought he was in the majors the whole year.
I think he played like 9 games in the minors this year.
But that was on. Does that rehab count as service? That was time, right.
Oh, was that rehab?
Yeah, that was just rehab.
Well, he hurt his calf, and I'm quoting. Calf, right?
You haven't played in a month, and you haven't much, and you haven't played well, so we're going to send you to Pawtucket with an injury.
I was down there in Pawtucket when he was rehabbing, and he wasn't hurt, but whatever. You know, he had a strained calf, so. Or quad, whatever one it was. But.
I used to love, I wonder how Bobby Valentine's going to handle those situations, because I used to love Tito talking about, he had a flare-up the other night, and it's just, he's clearly lying through his teeth. I wonder how Valentine's going to handle that. It makes you think for a second, maybe he really is hurt, and then you realize, like, calf doesn't just flare up after a game he didn't play in. At any rate, Melon, you got anything?
No, not right now. I mean, we'll get going as the season gets going. You know,
yeah. We'll definitely do this again before you guys go to spring training. So,
yeah, we'll be heading down this end of March 20th.
Yeah, right? You guys picked the one weekend of the spring that I couldn't go, and I appreciate that.
Yes, we'll be heading down March 20th, and we'll start up in mid February, start previewing.
Well,
all.
The 20th's a Tuesday, so
that's when I'm heading down.
Oh, well, look at you!
Yes,
look at you go.
Yeah, anyway. Maybe one day it'll be more than a week, but we'll see.
All right, well, thank you all for listening. I'm glad I didn't say up front, like we tend to that this was going to be a short podcast, because it wound up not being one. But at any rate, thanks for listening. Keep an eye on the news page. We've got all kinds of new stuff coming up. By the time we get our next one going, we might be getting into full spring training preview mode. Chris will have his positional. I'll do the positional outlooks. I don't know, maybe I'll make Melon do them too. But Melon will also be doing the scouting outlooks for the season. And we'll have some other new stuff there for you. Just keep an eye out for that and for the next podcast. Keep reading the site, and thanks for listening. Thanks to Chris and Ian for joining me, and we'll talk to you guys soon. See ya.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do. And start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.